Okay, good morning. I'll call to order the meeting of the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement for March 13th, 2009. We do not yet have a quorum, but I did want to get started with the discussion of the two items we have today. For planning purposes, we will be done at or before 12:30. Before we start on the first item, Senate File 131, House File 111, I'll just note that procedurally, we've got a little unusual situation here. Normally, in the Pensions Commission, we identify bills are introduced in both bodies, and as pension bills are introduced, they're sent to the respective government operations committees, and they sit there. And our pension staff identifies the bills that need to come before the Pensions Commission. And although the bills are still sitting within the House and Senate GovOps committees, we look at copies of the bills. We propose amendments to them. We prepare an omnibus pensions bill. And then when we're done with our work, then we take that draft omnibus pensions bill, and then we pull one of those bills that's in the GovOps committees. We amend the pensions bill onto that, and that bill goes forward as the omnibus pensions bill. The first item we have before us, as I say, is a little bit unusual because it is a separate bill. It's not strictly a pensions bill, although it does refer to the Pensions Commission and has some areas of interest to the Pensions Commission. The bills in both bodies have already passed through the policy committees in GovOps and have gone to the floor. And in the Senate, it's on general orders right now. So the bill is not in a place where this commission can actually amend the bill. Now, there are possible areas that we may have. There may be issues that could be amended, and if that is the case, then we'd have to work with the authors to figure out what's the best way to do that. One way is just to do it on the floor, which is not the preferred way. The other way is, at least within the Senate, to have it sent off of general orders into the Finance Committee and have it referred to the State Government Budget Division where we can review the amendment. So just for members who have an interest in that first bill, as I say, we have some procedural issues to take care of it. But we do have an interest in that bill, so that is why it's on the agenda today. So with that, let's see. Senator Bonhoff is here. I don't know if Representative Winkler is here as well, too. He's here. Okay. Senator Bonhoff and Representative Winkler, we have Senate File 131 and House File 111. So normally we have the staff explain the bill. I'll defer to you first to see if you have any explanations for the bill. And just for our discussion purposes, I think we'll assume that the United States Department of State has identified Iran as a terroristic state. So we don't have to establish that far. So with that in mind, welcome to the Pensions Commission. And could you discuss what your bill would propose to do?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Cox.
Can I make a brief explanation of what I'm passing out right now?
Go ahead.
What is being passed out right now actually is very appropriate this week because this week was the beginning of Purim, which is one of the festivals celebrated in the Jewish religion of the triumph of the Jews to stop annihilation from an evil person in the Persian Empire. And this is called the Feast of Esther, and Esther is one of the heroines in the Old Testament, although difficult for feminists in later life. But at any rate, the Esther's grave, in the tomb of Esther, is in fact in the city of Hamadan, which is part of modern Iran now. And so this is, again, sort of looking at the time when factions in what was ancient Persia and now modern Iran threatened not just the Jews, but possibly the whole world. And these pastries that are out here are called hamantaschen, and what they are is either Haman, who is the evil minister, they're either his pockets or his hats, whether you use the Hebrew or the Yiddish translation. So that's why I brought them for the divestiture.
Prior to the meeting, Representative Kahn asked me if she'd be violating Senate protocol because we do not normally allow food and drink or whatever in the meeting rooms. I said, well, we're acting as a joint House-Senate commission. So they can do it. This side of the table, you're in violation. Could somebody call the sergeant at arms right now? Okay, anyway.
Would you like to violate?
Senator Bonoff and Representative Winkler, again, welcome to the Pension Commission.
Senator, Mr. Chair, members, thank you for hearing us today. I'm actually going to let Representative Winkler talk about the bill, but we'd certainly love after to have some of Representative Kahn's Homintasha.
I will point out that they're actually Cecil's Homintasha, not mine.
Thank you.
I ran out of time this week.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. In your packets, you've stated accurately that Iran is one of four state sponsors of terrorism. The question then becomes, why a pension bill in Minnesota, and what could that do about that fact? The first thing I think you should note in your packet is that this policy of state divestment from foreign companies that do business in Iran's energy sector is the policy of the Obama administration. Senator Obama sponsored a bill when he was in the U.S. Senate to enable states to divest pension funds from companies that do business in Iran's energy sector. And in his administration already, March 3rd, the Associated Press reported that 11 firms tied to an Iranian bank have received sanctions from the United States government. So this is part of the active foreign policy of the United States. And Senator, now President Obama, specifically identified a state role in participating in that foreign policy. And the second piece, do the sanctions work? You should have, and maybe you don't have this, but there is a recent article in which the French oil company Total, which is one of the targeted companies in this list, has refused to take part in new exploration in Iran because of international sanctions. So one of the companies that is affected by this has already specifically identified international sanctions as a reason for not participating in a new energy sector development in Iran. If you want, your staff can go through the details of the bill, but essentially the bill requires the State Board of Investment to divest itself of foreign companies that are doing business in Iran's energy sector, 50% divestment in 9 months, 100% divestment in 15 months. So there is some time given to do that. There is an out in the bill to make the Pension Commission not have to follow this if this changes, if Iran is no longer on the state sponsorship of terror list, if the Secretary of State decides that this is not in the best foreign policy interest in the nation, this bill would not require that divestment. I should look at here. It's section. It must be section one. No, section two. No, it is. It's section one, subdivision seven. States that, and this is from House File 11, or 111, that if in the event that the State Board of Investment feels that its fiduciary obligations are in some way impinged by this divestment procedure, that they are not obligated to violate those fiduciary obligations. That is, the goal there is just to create some additional flexibility for the State Board of Investment to be consistent with its obligations to get the best possible return for the pension funds invested. Any smaller pension funds, this is just for the State Board of Investment, smaller pension funds are not obligated or targeted by this, mostly because they do a significant amount of investment in mutual funds. So any kind of mutual fund investment where you're buying a piece of a larger fund would not be included in this. If there are specific questions, we can take them. If your staff feels like there are details or more information that's needed, we can do that. But essentially, this bill requires that the state of Minnesota would no longer invest in foreign companies doing business in Iran's energy sector. And the reason it's foreign companies is because under federal law currently, domestic United States companies are not allowed to do business in that sector either. So this is only addressing those foreign countries like Gazprom, Lukoil, Total, that do business there currently.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bonoff.
I just also wanted to address the idea of, is this appropriate for the Minnesota legislature to take this action? And there is precedent for it. 2 years ago, I carried a bill that would have required The same thing of companies that did business with Darfur. That year, we did not end up passing that bill. Instead, they dealt with that at a board level. But the following year, Senator Pappas carried a similar bill, and that bill did pass into law. And so then there were some questions around, well, where does this stop? And so I would go back to that there are only four countries that are listed as state sponsors of terrorism. And one of them is the Sudan, another Iran, another Syria, and another Cuba. And so there is no slippery slope. This is quite a confined and targeted objective.
Well, and I don't know if you've had a chance to review. We will do in a few minutes. Have you received a copy of the report to the Pension Commission that was prepared by the pension staff? Have you seen that? And you've had a chance to review that? Okay, because we're going to be talking about that in a few minutes. First of all, any questions of either Senator Bonhoff or Representative Winkler on this? We're going to take testimony from others, but I want to see if there's questions of the authors first. Senator Limmer is also here. He's expressed an interest in it. Senator Limmer, did you wish to address the Pension Commission on this issue?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe that the authors have done an adequate job in representing the bill. My comments are is that if it's not just having a country that we invest in the corporations in that country, knowing that it is now on a terrorist-sponsored state list by the federal government, recognized not only by the former Bush administration but also by the Obama administration, if that's not enough to divest ourselves from investments in that country, I think it's important for the pension board to realize that this country state is in a very risky and precarious position politically. And I believe there's a number of articles that are being presented throughout financial worlds that are recognizing that as well. Iran's economy is in a vulnerable state. The country's faced with growing difficulties, international isolation, inadequate foreign investment, declining oil production, rising domestic energy consumption, high inflation, and political unease. Think of those factors when we think of whether or not that's a good place to invest pension funds. Certainly, other countries have recognized it as well. These institutions have been highlighted by the United States, the European Union, the Financial Action Task Force of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. All of these entities are recognizing not only the state of Iran as a terrorist sponsoring state, but it's in a very shaky economic condition. And I think that's as important to our pensioners as it is to those that follow international politics and the growing threat and the absolute crazy talk that's coming out of Iran, talking that it wants to annihilate its neighbors, as well as making direct threat to the United States. I think we have to keep in mind that even apart from that, this country is in a very, and I must emphasize, very precarious economic condition, and it probably is not the wisest place to invest our money.
And just to be clear, and in a minute I want the, if Mr. Bichler is available, I want to hear from State Board of Investment on these issues, if he could come forward. People should be aware that the Pensions Commission does not get involved in directing how the pension funds are going to be investing their money. If somebody could vacate one of their seats, Mr. Bichler can sit down and get another seat up there. Obviously, we have an interest in how they do it, because when they do a very bad job and it winds up having the pension funds being jeopardized because of bad decisions they made, we want to know that. Typically, it's not the Pension Commission that does that, but as I say, we do pay attention to how, you know, what is being done there. In particular, this bill does require reports to come to the Pension Commission, so we have to figure out just how much really does affect us and how much we can change policy as opposed to other areas within the legislature. Mr. Bichler, welcome to the Pension Commission. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm Howard Bichler. I'm the director of the State Investment Board. What I'd like to do is just talk about some of the factual issues as it relates to this, and then talk about some potential alternatives. We did the analysis as of December 31st, so this is 12/31/08 numbers. As of that point in time, this had the potential effect of divesting $280 million worth of securities. This is approximately 5.6% of our entire international portfolio. It's over 1% of our entire portfolio, and at that point in time, it affected over two-thirds of the international integrated oil companies. The board also does a fair amount of passive investment, and if we are limited with various companies, we will not be able to passively invest our investments to various indices that will still include these companies. Mr. Chairman, members, we've also, there's been some discussion about the Sudan legislation, which the legislature passed a couple of years ago. There are some differences between the Sudan legislation and this legislation. The Sudan legislation did require divestiture, and it was passed, and we've implemented it, and we have divested approximately $24 million worth of securities, which is significantly less than the potential of $280 million. And also in Section 7 of the proposed legislation, there is another significant difference in the sense that the Sudan legislation, when it passed, said you go through various engagements and then you have various time frames over which to divest. This legislation has a lot of the same language, but also says the State Board, if it deems this would breach its fiduciary responsibility, does not need to go ahead. And that is a significant difference, Mr. Chairman and members, in the sense that if the legislature deems the divestment is appropriate, you know, that's one thing. This kind of says we kind of like you to divest, but we'll leave it up to you.
And that's on page 4, lines 4.4 to 4.6. Go ahead.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. We would like to suggest a potential alternative approach or a different way of viewing this, and that is the board has in the past initiated various shareholder resolutions related to various companies. We've done it back in the old days with South Africa. We've done it with pharmaceutical companies. We've done it with tobacco companies. We've done it with companies related to Northern Ireland. Now, in full disclosure, we have not done this on international companies, and this would be a new area for us to embark on. But a lot of people would argue that you are much more effective if your goal is to have companies change their operations or affect change, you're much more likely to have an effect on their business if you initiate shareholder resolutions or work with the company than to sell them. You sell them, you get your name in the paper one day, and believe me, after that, the company doesn't care. If you initiate shareholder resolutions or initiate discussions with them and work with other organizations, you have the potential to be much more effective. So, Mr. Chairman and members, we would like you all to at least contemplate or think about a potential amendment that instead of telling the board that you have the option of not doing this if you believe it would breach your fiduciary responsibility, give the board the option to engage these companies through various activities, including shareholder resolutions. So, Mr. Chairman and members, there is a lot of similarities between this piece of legislation and the Sudan legislation that was enacted, but there are significant changes in the sense of the size and the magnitude and the ability, at least in the proposed legislation, for the board to basically say, we believe this is breaching our fiduciary responsibility and we're not going to divest. We're suggesting a potential alternative in the sense of engaging these companies through various vehicles, including shareholder resolutions.
Any questions, Mr. Becker, or Representative Kahn?
Well, Mr. Chairman, first of all, I think that that's an advantage to allow you to use your fiduciary responsibilities. For example, that's obviously if interfering with the investment in with the passive investments would clearly fall under that that category. And there's nothing in this. Have you gotten involved in shareholder resolutions without instructions from the legislature?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, yes.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman, then there's no need to put specific instructions to do that. It seemed to me obvious that if divestiture looks important, particularly when we're following the federal government and we're following various other states, the divestiture could be the tool that's used. And if you decide that you shouldn't because of your fiduciary responsibilities, then it seems that the option to do a shareholder resolution is just before you, and you could just do that at the same time.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Kahn, first of all, if you divest the stock, you can't initiate shareholder resolutions because you don't have the stock.
I know. Mr. Chairman, I specifically tied that to the decision where you decide not to divest the stock.
So.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Kahn, there are a lot of alternatives. It's just been my experience with the legislature over the years is if they want something done, they usually tell us to get something done and not tell us you got a bunch of options. But that is absolutely within the legislative preview. We will respond to whatever is ultimately enacted by the legislature.
Sir Pappas?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think this is a good suggestion, but I think we should – offer it as an amendment, because I am concerned that the fiduciary responsibilities, while responsible, because it's such a large amount of money, could result in even no divestment. So rather than have no divestment, I would suggest we have an amendment that if the board decides it's inconsistent with fiduciary responsibilities, then they would proceed with a shareholder resolution. Or they could do both. Okay. But sure. not the stocks they divest, just the ones they decide not to.
Sir Bonoff, did you have something?
Mr. Chairman, I like Senator Pappas's suggestion. I was going to comment, we put this in there really in response to understanding how large the dollars were that we were talking about and wanting to be respectful of the board and give them flexibility. But I think to go with a strictly shareholder resolution strategy would be a mistake. The federal government has made it very clear they will not invest in these kinds of companies, that is their preference. Then there's enabling legislation for states. And I think given Minnesota's leadership position in so many areas around the country that we ought to be consistent with the 14 other states that are pursuing this kind of legislation, and that it's an important step to take.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, I guess my comment would be that much larger pension funds, most notably Florida, started this. And Florida went through a process of complete divestment. And I'm afraid that if Minnesota goes down a path of not divestment but a shareholder resolution, that it doesn't necessarily make it more effective. It just indicates that some states are less aggressive and less concerned about this than other states are. And it may actually send exactly the wrong signal.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, I think Representative Kahn and Senator Pappas' suggestion is an excellent suggestion.
Is there anybody else who's here who wants to be heard? I'm going to hear from staff in just a minute on the issues that relate to the Pensions Commission, but is there anybody else who wants to weigh in on this issue right now? As I said, the without getting into the merits of the bill, it does direct certain things relating to the Pensions Commission, and that is something that is flagged by the staff. Mr. Burr, could you comment on some of the issues that are before the commission here?
Mr. Chairman, members, the first issue I raise regards reporting to the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement. The bill requires two primary sets of reports. One set of reports deals with situations where SBI has decided not to divest because SBI concludes that to do so would be a breach of its fiduciary duties. And under the bill, reports dealing with those activities would be given periodically to the commission, although not to the executive director, but just to the...
It's sent to me. And
yeah, right, and to the chair.
I don't want it. I want it to go to these people. If you send it to me, it's going to get lost.
That certainly is an issue. I don't mean the...
No, I organize lost, my stuff well, but I get a stack.
You know, it's an issue as to whether or not the executive director should receive that. Related to this, the other set of reports, and the other set deals with the cases where SBI has taken some action to engage the companies to divest. And those reports go to the policy committees. So one of the concerns I raise is that it seems like no single legislative group is seeing the whole pictures. They're seeing half the picture. The commission, as this is drafted, would be told of those cases where no action was taken. The policy committees would be told of the cases where actions were taken, but no single committee is receiving both of those. So the commission may wish to consider some amendments to revise the reporting and who receives those reports. Sufficient impact to justify administrative burden. A lot of this has been touched on. Mr. Bicker, for instance, indicated that it may be far more effective not to divest but simply to engage these companies through shareholder resolutions and other activities. And I raise a related point here, and that is that divesting may really have no impact on the company, but it may have a considerable impact on SBI. What may happen in terms of the company is there is really no impact on the value of the shares of the company, but simply a change in the distribution of ownership. SBI would own none, and other investors would own more. That, however, by changing that distribution, though, that has the implication that, again, Mr. Bicker hit on, that that would influence the ability of SBI to invest in passive portfolios as they're now structured. If you're trying to match a particular market, you need to either invest in all the securities in that market or a representative sample that would give you the same end result. And if there's a segment that you can't invest in, then you can't achieve that target. So either you have to settle for a much wider error because of what you're required to omit, or SBI would be required to go back to the drawing board and decide on an entirely new index, an entirely new target. I also raise a question about the scope of the investments that are covered. My reading of the bill, is looking particularly at page 1, lines 16 to 18, it simply refers to equity holdings. And it would seem that under this bill, under certain circumstances, there would be a need to divest of equity holdings, but there's no mention of debt. Presumably, if we don't want SBI to hold the equity securities of these companies, I don't know why we would want them to hold bonds of these companies. So the commission may want to consider an amendment to change the scope. We also note that there's no effective date. The commission may wish to consider adding an effective date.
Well, as I said earlier, we're not really in a position to adopt any amendments because the bills are on the floor. And so the only way to really amend it would be to either do it on the floor or in the committee process, you know, however either body wishes to do that. I think, and I can only speak for the Senate, preference, not, you know, how the House chooses to do it is up to them, but Senator Bogomiller is quite concerned about having, I think, these kind of amendments done on the floor of the Senate. He would prefer to work through the committee process, so I think he would like to have the bill from the Senate move to the Finance Committee, the State Government Budget Division, and have those issues amended there, if that's the choice of the process. Representative Kahn, did you have any thoughts?
Well, I don't think that these are, if the bill is going to pass, I don't think that these are major amendments. First of all, without an effective date, I assume the effective date is August 1st. And so that's not a problem. Second of all, the thing that seems to make the most sense to me is the changing of the reporting status. And I haven't, you know, of course, haven't been on the Senate floor very much, but I do believe that in the course of things I've witnessed, the Senate has done much more extensive amendments on the floor of the Senate, changing the reporting from people who will take care of it sensibly to people who will lose it in their pile of papers doesn't seem to be a major philosophical amendment. And I would suggest that the authors of the bill who are here and some of the co-authors who are on the Pension Commission take, in a sense, the sense of the Pension Commission about what direction they would like to go. I certainly want to change the reporting thing. And take it to the floors of the respective houses where it's always appropriate for any member of that body to say, this is too big a change to do on the floor and we should send it back to committee. And then that could be done at that time.
Well, again, Representative Kahn, how the House chooses to deal with its bill is fine. I know what the Senate would prefer to how it prefers to handle this bill. So,
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, I don't understand why the bill got sent to the floor in the first place and didn't get sent to finance. Because it clearly has to do with
I don't know. I was there for part of the State Government Operations Committee. I couldn't stay for the whole thing, so I don't know. It did get sent to the floor. That's where we're at. So as I say, we're kind of at the end of where we can go in this commission with this particular issue. Is there anybody else who wants to be heard on this issue at this time? Sarah Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make a comment about something that the staff implied, and that is that I think the strength in this is in working towards that full divestment. And this isn't something that we can – that our ability to make a difference here is not just Minnesota, but it's the cumulative effect that we have in joining with those other states. And I think that is something that needs – consideration here. This is a different sort of situation than many of the things that come before this commission. This is far more global in nature, and I just ask members to consider that.
And that's why it deserves thoughtful discussion. And of course, neither you nor Senator Olson nor Senator Rosen are on the Senate's State Government Budget Division. Senator Pappas and Senator Lehman and I are. So, Senator Olson, do you have a thought?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, I'm not an investment expert, so but this just question occurred to me. If a lot of states in the federal government are moving in this direction, wouldn't there be passive investment funds that would be likely to put the same kind of restrictions on their fund? In other words, you know, this is a fund you can go to. They do a lot of things. You don't have to be directly involved, except they are not going to do this. And it seems to me that just kind of makes sense to me that there would be funds that would respond to these concerns. And so it wouldn't necessarily be the either-or situation that you're describing.
Mr. Becker?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson. That may be a outcome at some point in time. The discussion about a number of other states doing this, there has been legislation passed in a lot of states. A lot of states are sitting there with this fiduciary issue yet to be voted on. They have the quote-unquote, if this breaches your fiduciary responsibility. The fact is, I was talking to my two counterparts at CalPERS and CalSTRS, and their boards are going to be voting on that issue in the next 2 or 3 months. At this stage, it's too close to call. The reality is there's been some legislation done. There has not been a lot of divestment. It also does not affect any corporate plans. It does not affect any mutual funds, and that's the vast majority of the market.
Okay. Anything further from anybody? As I say, we're this is as far as we can go in this commission, but we needed to review, you know, the areas that it did affect us. And Sarbanoff will be in touch, but as I say, my recommendation is to get the bill to the Finance Committee, and we will process it as soon as we can in the Senate Budget Division. How the House chooses to do it is up to the House.
Mr. Chairman, just to summarize what I heard from the committee and make sure that we're all hearing the same thing, is that the committee supports the direction that this bill takes us and would like to not only put in an amendment with regard to reporting, but also put in that if the pension committee decides, because of its fiduciary responsibilities, not that they are not able to fully divest, that you'd like or might suggest to have the shareholder resolution as an option for the board. Is that...
Well, yes, Senator Bonhoff, without the H. There's obviously some technical things that have to be corrected, and those are obvious. And as Representative Kahn said, those can be handled rather quickly. I think there is a couple of issues as to how to do it, which is what Mr. Bicker was talking about. And maybe there's a sense of this commission, but then you've got legislators in both bodies that may also have thoughts as to a different way. So we can only speak for the group that we have here right now. Senator Lynch?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonhoff, I don't think it's clear what the position of the commission is to Senator Bonhoff.
Yeah, okay.
Or it's not clear
okay.
in my mind.
Okay.
And so I think we do need to have a little bit more clarity in fairness to the authors as they move forward from this commission, particularly with regard to the suggestion about including direct holdings. So that would be Amendment 2A, for example. I do think that there's not clarity in direction from this commission with regard to including shareholder resolutions, yes or no. And I think that that would be helpful information for the authors to have as they move forward.
This may be an issue, however, where we have to let each legislative body work independently and figure out, you know, what each body wants to do. The pension commission's the things that directly affect us are fairly limited. The bigger policy issues, I think, need to be vetted out, and what we choose to do here is not going to be binding on either legislative body. I mean, they're going to do what they wish to do. So all I know is that it's a complex issue.
Mr. Chair, I guess I would add that the other option, of course, with respect to the fiduciary obligation is to remove that bit of flexibility and simply direct the board to divest and state in law that they are not they're not violating any fiduciary responsibility by doing so, which is more similar to the Darfur legislation. So if that would be consistent with past practice and absolve them of the challenge of taking a vote and identifying and taking some risk about what their fiduciary obligation is, certainly that is an option as well.
Well, each author needs to think what you want to do, and we'll see at conference.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Bicker, when you gave us the figure of $280 million potential, does that include all the assets and passive portfolios as well?
Mr. Bicker.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, that's correct.
That's correct. And Mr. Chairman, and then I don't remember exactly, but it seems to me from the hearing that the legislation zeroed in on oil companies. In particular, so when you said two-thirds are oil companies, did you mean two-thirds of that $280 million?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, it's all the oil companies. It's two-thirds of the international oil opportunity set. So, in other words, two-thirds of the international oil companies that we can invest in are affected by this legislation.
Okay.
The two-thirds are basically the $280 million.
Okay.
Well, if there's nothing further, as I say, or Senator Lynch, you have something
further. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Let me try this once again.
Okay.
So the authors are going to move forward with this legislation in whatever form they determine is best for their respective bodies, and that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But at their next step, what kind of message are we sending with the authors now as they leave the Pension Commission? I don't feel that we've given them any direction, opinion, or suggestion or comment with regard to divesting or not divesting or direct holdings or equity interests only. Well, and in those two areas, I think that we are situated well to at least offer them some comment or direction or leaning.
Well, and again, whatever this commission were to suggest is not going to be binding on the next, certainly the next stop as it goes through the process. So, I mean, it's like any other bill. The authors just have to kind of review the information, make their best proposal, and then once it's thrown into the laps of the committees or the full bodies of the legislative process, the legislature does its will after that. So, Representative Kahn.
Well, what I think Senator Lynch is suggesting, and I would certainly go along with her, is that along the lines of the four things that she's said, is that we pass a sense of the commission, if it passes, that this is so that when they go forward to either the floors of the House or if the bill is sent from the floors of the House back to finance committees, that that's what they'll be able to say. And I think having – I think Senator Lynch listed a set of perfectly reasonable things.
Senator Lynch, is there something that you want the Pension Commission to discuss so that we can see where we're at? As I say, any vote we take is not going to be binding because we can't amend the bill. But if you have a particular issue you want us to discuss to see where the members are at, that's probably appropriate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are a number of them, and I think maybe to start with, just along the lines, I'm not suggesting that I understand we can't adopt the 2A amendment, but I think the 2A amendment gets at one of the issues that staff pointed out to us with regard to should direct holdings be included here, and that would be in terms of the scope where the reference was to line 1.16. And would it be helpful for the authors as they move forward if they had some sense of where the Pension Commission weighed in on that?
Well, what's your position, Senator Lynch?
I think that the scope should be increased.
Okay. Any thoughts or comments from members?
I agree.
Okay. We've got a couple of people who are in agreement. Senator Lynch, anything else?
Mr. Chair, I think another area that the Pension Commission could serve the authors is with regard to the discussion around shareholder resolutions, to include, to not include, what kind of latitude do we want to get there. And
well, Mr. Chairman, three of us said we thought that was a good idea.
Mm-hmm. And I think the shareholders' resolution is a good idea.
Okay.
Now, whether that's the only thing, we may differ on that, but I think that should be something that the state board has the opportunity to do, which the bill does not provide for, which apparently they can do it, whether it's in there or not.
Okay.
But if we're going to pass legislation, maybe it ought to be addressed. So,
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Boff,
if you could clarify in terms of the commission. Or the Pension Commission, shareholder resolution is your preference, including the divestment opportunity versus only shareholder resolution?
Yes,
I just want to clarify.
I guess my preference would be do the shareholder first, not the divestment. But that's just my thought. If you're asking us, I mean, we're not going to take a vote because there's nothing to vote on. But if you want some sense of where people are at, that's where I'm at.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Kahn.
I actually think we should craft a policy and take a vote. It's not the same as an amendment, but it just gives. And, you know, I think Senator Lynch is outlining what the policy should be. We'll have a paragraph that goes off with the authors, and it understands it's not an amendment, but that's, I think it would be helpful.
A sense of the Pensions Commission?
Yes.
Right.
Okay.
Yes.
I suppose we can do that. Again, you know, we're not amending anything. It's not binding. But if you want to know where the members of the Pension Commission are at, and that doesn't – not going to bind the next stop.
Right. But if we did an amendment to a bill, it doesn't bind the next stop either.
I understand. Okay.
So.
Well, okay. What is the suggestion?
The suggestion is that in cases where following their fiduciary responsibility, they decide not to divest – that then the option of a shareholder resolution is then ought to be pursued.
But the policy would be that they we want them to divest.
Yes.
Right.
If they choose not to, then they should submit a resolution.
Yes.
Okay. That's the suggestion. Okay. Discussion on the suggestion. Okay. Let's. Okay. Those who think that's a good suggestion, raise your hands.
I got a copy back.
1, 2, 3. I can't. Representative Thiessen, is it your hand up or down?
I'm passing because I don't
okay,
know.
Okay,
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Okay. Six people think it's a good suggestion. Those who think it's not a good suggestion, raise your hands. Okay. I don't think it's a good. 1, 2. Two do not think it's a good suggestion. Okay.
Okay. Well, right
any
now,
other suggestions?
The chair will just note 6 to 2.
Yeah. That's fine. And
but that
anybody
could change tomorrow.
Anybody listens to the tape is going to hear 6 to 2. Okay. Sarah Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to go back to the discussion, but on our list of suggestions, it would be then expanding the scope.
Yes.
And could you explain?
With regard to the direct holdings.
Two-way.
Two-way. The two-way amendment.
The two-way.
Okay. And Mr. Becker, what did the State Board have a thought on the two-way amendment? Did you have a chance to look at that, expanding the scope?
Mr. Chairman and members, the first time I saw it was when I came in here this morning, so I really haven't had a chance to look at that. I really don't know what additional effect that would have on us, but I assume it would have some more additional effect as we would have to be liquidating, assuming we went to the divestiture of some additional fixed income securities. I really do not know.
Okay. Those who think the 2A is a good suggestion, raise your hands. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Those who do not, raise your hands. Those who aren't sure, raise your hands. Okay. So there's it's 5, 0, 1, 3, 4. Four don't know. Okay. Okay. Any other suggestions? Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair, as long as we're providing suggestion and direction as
that's
we go forward, then I think we should make a suggestion that there is an effective date put in. And it looks like that would encompass the 1A amendment.
Okay. But what should the date be?
It looks July 1st, 2009 is a suggestion.
July 1st of 2009, effective date. Okay.
So that's when engagement starts.
Yeah.
Yes, okay. And I agree there should be an effective date. Okay, those who think having an effective date with July 1st of 2009 is a good suggestion, please raise your hands. Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Okay. It looks like this one would quite well.
Mr. Chair, is there custom and usage on authors having an ability to speak to the sense of the commission?
No.
No. I'm kind of making up as we go along.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're in uncharted territory.
Mr. Chairman,
I think the other technical amendments, kind of, the clarification with reporting is one. There may be others. I think that Senator Boniff can take our discussion and the recommendations from staff and take that on to the next level.
Are you suggesting that they consider technical amendments?
Yes.
Okay. Those who think they should consider the technical amendment, please raise your hands. Okay. Again, you've got some good direction here. Now, do you have direction, Senator Boniff?
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. Thank you, Senator Lynch. Thank you, members. We do have direction and a sense of the commission.
Good luck.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair.
Okay. The bill is laid over because I can't do anything more with it, so we'll see you at some point later on. The next item we have on our agenda is Senate number 2. Well, let's get the minutes out of the way first. We do have the minutes of the March 10 meeting. Representative Murphy moves the minutes of the March 10, 2009 meeting. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, the meetings are adopted. This item is going to be the MRF consolidation with PERA General. The bill has been out for a little while, and it's been scheduled. I was notified about 2 days ago the city of Minneapolis wanted more time for discussions on this, and I talked to Representative Thiessen, who's the House author on this one. And we do want to go ahead and go through this because we are, frankly, running out of time before the deadlines. We would like to understand this proposal and so forth. Representative Thiessen has suggested, though, that we table the bill after we're done with the discussion, not take a vote today. However, I don't know when you know, when the proposed resolution would come. We still have to keep the bills moving and so forth. If it doesn't, if the resolution isn't ready by the time we're ready to move the bill through committees, that's fine. I mean, as a last resort, we could always move this one separately. That's going to take a little bit of a – we have to go to the leadership, to like the Speaker of the House, who's from Minneapolis, and the Senate Majority Leader, who's from Minneapolis, and see if they'd be willing to let us do that. But so we they may have some additional time to work on it, but May 18th really is the ultimate time deadline. So so we do want to spend some time talking about this, but as I say, that is the request of the House author, is to not make a final decision today, and so that the parties can keep working on this. So who – do we have somebody who wants to discuss it? Otherwise, I'll just turn over to staff to have the description of the bill. Let's see. This would be –
Mr. Chair? Mr. Chair, can I just make a few general comments in advance of the description of the bill, just kind of set out kind of what I see as the problem here?
Yeah, please go ahead.
Well, and the first thing I guess I would say, as I've kind of gotten more into this, is this is really an incredibly serious situation. And if people remember the Minneapolis teacher's retirement, this probably is worse. It seems like it could be worse than that. In terms of the immediacy of the need for action here and the scope of the problem. So we have a closed fund here with about $750 to $800 million in assets, roughly. I mean, we don't know exactly because of what the stock market has been doing, but in that range, which is a substantial drop in recent years. And we have annual payouts to retirees in the range of about $150 million right now. And if you just do the math on that, this fund runs out of money in a very short period of time, 5, 6, 7 years kind of range. You know, so the bottom line here is we have made, as a public sector, as a community, a promise to these retirees. They're not connected with Social Security, so this is all the pension that they have. And facing their really very real possibility, this fund's going to have no assets to pay them. And so we really, in that sense, have to do something, and we have to do it quickly. The current estimate is that it's going to be really tens of millions of dollars a year for the next 10 years to keep the fund viable, and you know, as much as $75 million a year, $74 million a year. And I also want to make sure that people understand we can't grow ourselves out of this problem with unless we have extraordinary returns. You know, if we have a payout of $150 million a year, and that's going to continue to grow as a few more people retire, and we get a 10% return on that, that's in the range of, you know, $75 million. So we're still short $75 million that the fund is going to go down in that scenario, dropping it further down, and then that's just a downward cycle that becomes ultimately unsustainable. So money needs to go into this fund if we're going to sustain it. We can't invest our way out of it. I do want to make a couple other points about the bill. The first, and this is really important, I think it's important that we keep this clear with everybody, including constituents and all the stakeholders, is that current paramembers don't, under this bill, and I think should not bear the burden or cost of absorbing the fund. We need to find another revenue source to do that. And so MRF is going to come in, at least in my opinion, has to come in fully funded so that we're not putting that burden on the members of PARA who are out there. And that's the intent of the bill. That's what the language of the bill is. And we need to keep that clear when constituents contact you about this bill, that's the intent and where things are going. I also think it's important that we can't, as a state, allow public employees to be left with no pension. So we have to fix this. And the last thing I'd say is there have been commitments by the city and the school district to this fund, and that's kind of the way law is structured. But I also think the state has a responsibility here, both historically, when the merger happened or when the decisions were made in 1979 to keep some of these funds closed, and also by the fact that the state sets the terms of the benefits and the payouts. You know, we do that through statute. So the city and the school district, at some level, don't have any choice over what the benefits and the payouts are going to be. So I do think that they're is a state responsibility here as well, and we need to consider that as we move forward with this legislation. So that's kind of just to set the stage for the discussion, and I appreciate that we have the chance to kind of weigh through these things.
Okay, thank you.
I mean, the bill is rather lengthy, but they basically the bill provides for rolling MERV into PERA. Now, that's a huge issue unto itself. And as you indicated, Representative Thiessen, there's liabilities that would go along with that as it stands now because it's a closed fund. If we do nothing, the situation gets worse. So we do have to figure out what the options are and whether this bill accomplishes that or not, I don't know. So, you know, we'll certainly hear from some testimony as to discussion. Representative Murphy, you have some questions?
I just have one question. Sure. What's the membership of MERV?
Oh, thank you. The membership of MERV employees of Minneapolis, employees of the school district, employees of the MAC. There's some MinSCU employees involved. And I think there's one other category that I'm forgetting. But about 80% is employees of the city of Minneapolis, or former employees largely.
And how many are in the fund?
Members, if you look on page 14 of the memo, you've got the most recent and several prior years' actuarial work. And that includes at the very top the membership of the plan. We're talking 211 active members of MERV as of June 30, 2008.
That's this sheet in here. Sarah Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess just to make sure so that I understand the proposal, the MERV retirement fund, absent some action by the state, this would be a responsibility of the city of Minneapolis to fund? Representative Thiessen?
Mr. Chair, and I think I'd like the staff to address this a little bit, but the way that the statute is structured right now, there's a state share that goes into this, which is about $9 million a year. And then the way I read, reading the statute, and then after that, the city or the employer, so it would be the city or the school district or the MAC or whoever, would pick up the difference.
We have an ongoing appropriation every biennium, yes. Sarah Olson, yeah.
So, Mr. Chair, then I guess the question I would have is because I'm assuming that if we did this, it's going to have an impact on the rest of the statewide retirees who are in PERA in terms of having to, say, absorb or we're going to have to come up with the money, you know, to replace this. So is that a policy that would be available for cities statewide if we were to do that? Because otherwise I'm just wondering how I would explain to constituents in rural Minnesota that we had a separate policy for Minneapolis retirees that would be different for any other municipality's retirees in terms of taking on statewide responsibility for filling this gap.
And we've already done that because when the Minneapolis Teachers Fund went down, we had to roll them into TRA. So and there's still some of your constituents in TRA that are still probably upset that they assumed, but they got a benefit increase out of the process. But it was a difficult decision to do. Representative Thiessen?
I think Representative Kahn made.
The point is everyone else was rolled into PERA. I don't think there are any other individual funds out there in any localities. So everyone went into PERA. The decisions of why MERV didn't go and why Minneapolis teachers didn't go are, you know, one can arguably say were a bad decision. But I don't think it has any, I mean, particularly if this is done in a way that the fund is held harmless. But there's no other city that's in this predicament.
And Mr. Chair, just to get a little more clarification, first of all, again, PERA is not going to absorb the cost of this. So it's not going to be on the PERA employees, and that's clear in the bill. The second thing is, I mean, it was 30 years ago that this decision was made not to roll in at MERV into the PERA. The active employees that were hired after that date are already in PERA. So it's just the people that came in before 1979 that are not, and that's who this MERV pool is. That's why there's so few active people left. When that happened in 1979, really three funds were left out, but two of those funds, City of Minneapolis took responsibility for making sure that it was fully funded, and the state actually took responsibility for making sure MERV without a capped amount was fully funded. And then that was changed in 1991 as part of some other legislation that I don't know all the larger details. So at one point, the thought was. And then but I also think it is important we keep in mind that we do set the rules about, you know, it's not the city of Minneapolis and the school district. They don't have any control over how much the benefits are, what any of that is. That is the people around this table that have set that for 30 years. So I think that there is, from that perspective also, there is a state responsibility.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Thiessen, I appreciated your comment that in order that we can fix this, that MRF needs to come into PARA fully funded.
Yes.
I think that's an important consideration, certainly. But Representative Thiessen, or perhaps to staff, is there a document here that lays out for us what that amount is or what that responsibility is for each of those entities, just to kind of put this in perspective?
Mr. Chair, the number I have is about $74 million total if we do it as of 2010, which is how this bill – the way the bill is structured is that we have – we're setting a date of July 1st, 2010 is the merger date. And then in the interim, we're going to work out how we're going to pay for that $74 million. But that's the scope. $9 million is from this – well, it's over 10 years, though. Yeah. It's been over 10 years.
And that's why the city of Minneapolis isn't quite ready to weigh in, because it's going to involve them and their taxpayers, and so and they're not quite sure how they're going to get there yet. So,
yeah.
Senator Lynch?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, so of the $74 million, then, is there something that will show me of the various entities that are a part of this equation, what is the percentage of each?
$9 million comes from the state under that appropriation, so we're down to 65 million. About 80% of that roughly is the city itself, and then the school district takes up almost the rest of the amount, and then there's little bits from Minsky and Mac, and that's my understanding of this of the breakdown. So we're looking at, what is that, about 14 million to the school district and close to 45 million for the city.
And we should keep in mind that a lot of the people affected don't all live in the city of Minneapolis.
That's
they live
right.
everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's the issue we had with Minneapolis Teachers Fund, is that you know, they're all our constituents. So we have to keep in mind that it does affect people not just in Minneapolis. Senator Olson.
And, Mr. Chair, and I'm sure that's true, and considering a lot of them retired in my district, that's probably very true. But I'm just wondering, and I appreciate Thiessen, that bit of background for those of us who are newer to the Pensions Commission, because I think that's very helpful. But I'm just wondering the reason that MRF is in this situation right now.
Okay.
Is this a question of underfunding it? Is it a question of people are living longer than expected? Is it the economy, or is it just a combination? Could you give us a little background on that?
And, Mr. Chair, and I'll give some. We may want to have some of the staff. There's a couple things. One of the things is we changed how we reported our valuations a couple of years ago to go from kind of an actuarial valuation in these, because this has a post fund. Remember last year we merged the post fund and the other things. This still has that going on. We changed how we value those things from an actuarial valuation to a market valuation. So that masked some of the problem for a while, because we were looking the numbers. And you can even see that on page 14 here. If you look, and there's two columns for 2007. And we don't have to go through that right now, but it made a significant change. The stock market collapse clearly had a big impact on this in recent years. And I think there's actually a memo that the staff did that kind of lays out some of the other reasons for the funding discrepancies.
Let me call Mr. Martin. Yeah. He can probably give some background, too, and I'm sure Representative Kahn has. So, Mr. Martin?
Well, members, to try and briefly summarize how a plan that was set up in 1919 got into the circumstance that it's in now is a little daunting, but this plan is a basic member plan. It does not have Social Security, so it provides a larger benefit than our normal public pension plans that are coordinated with Social Security. So the 211 people who are covered by the plan and all the retirees did not have Social Security by virtue of their employment. They only have the MRF pension unless they did part-time employment, in addition to employment, got their 40 quarters and have Social Security coverage from some other source. So this plan is inherently more expensive as a basic program than most of PERA, most of TRA. The plan once was a single employer plan back when the school district was part of the city of Minneapolis, we hadn't split off the sewer workers, given them over to the Metropolitan Council. The airports commission didn't exist. So Minneapolis once was the sole employer. We fragmented the employer, so now there's a separate Minneapolis employing unit. The school district is separate. The MAC has a number of employees at the MAC are covered by MRF. There were sewer workers with the Met Council, the janitors, and some of the other clerical or functionary folk, non-teaching folk, at the Minneapolis Tech College are part of MRF. So there's a mix of employers, and it's a fairly complicated structure to calculate the liabilities and the ongoing contributions for each group under MRF law. This plan was well on the way to being very well funded. If you look at page 14 and you roll back to 2006, this plan was 92% funded. Now, as Representative Thiessen mentioned, some of what was going on is masked by the way we calculated the value of assets for the post our retirement function in this plan. This plan has a post-retirement fund identical to the post fund that the various statewide plans had until last year. And historically, the way, for better or for worse, the way that the assets probably in the post fund were valued, they were valued at equal to the required reserves of other members receiving the benefits. So they were 100% funded by definition, but not necessarily by virtue of their market value of their assets. This was noted by the legislative auditor as contrary to generally accepted accounting principles in 2006, and we changed. Hence, the two values of assets, the two sets of our results that you see on page 14 for the year 2007, the year that was put into place. We started using the market value of the post fund, or in the case of MRF, the retirement benefit fund. We started using the actual market value in 2007, and that was a significant drop-off. The retirement benefit fund, which had been very well funded, did take a shock in 2001, 2002, following the 9/11, the 9/11 attacks and the recession that occurred after that. And again, is taking a shot by virtue of the current our recession. In 1979, the state first became a participant in funding MRF, and this was part of an arrangement that was reached by the tax committee, not by the pension commission, where the city of Minneapolis did not receive an increase in local government aid that year, and instead had the state participate in MRF funding. It was anticipated that those would be fairly modest amounts of money. They turned out not to be very modest amounts of money, in part because of a prior executive director at MRF and some of the investment and other difficulties that he caused the pension fund, which were eventually resolved. The state at one point, if you look at here at page 20, there's a description of the state aid to MRF, and if you look at the aid amounts in the early in the the 18 in the 19 late 1980s, you see a progressively increasing dollar amount of aid to MRF, and part of that was because of some difficulties within MRF. Eventually, the state aid was capped in 1991, first at $10.4 million, and then subsequently, a few years later, to $9 million. If you look at late 1990s and early 2000s, the state contribution was relatively small by the historic standards, dropping to as low as 3.11 million in 2000, and it's been steadily climbing back up to the $9 million figure. So it's a historical high-cost pension fund because it's a basic plan, a somewhat tangled funding mechanism because of the multiple employers. The arrangement of the retirement benefit fund masked some of the market losses that occurred, so we were not recognizing them incrementally over time, but all at once. There were changes in the amount of state participation in the funding of the plan. Some internal difficulties with MRF during the 1980s, and then the most recent set of our recessions. And this is a plan with very few active members, so very little. The contribution stream coming into the plan is very small. The contribution, the dollar benefit payout is very, very large in this plan. So there's very little room for, very little margin to recapture lost investment performance because of that negative cash flow.
As I'm looking at the, just charting through from pages 14 to 18, I noticed around the time that the fund was closed out, it was only 50% funded, and it grew particularly by the 90s, which is because I think of state aids and because the stock market was doing well. But is that those are the main reasons why it was able to build up during that time period?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
And now we've got the problem with some of these darn people live too long, and that creates a bit of a drain. Representative Conn, did you have something to add?
Yes, another. You know, I lived through all these days of putting the state appropriation in and then the cap. And part of the reason for it, and I'm not sure it's thoroughly explored in this memo, is the fact that the rules, the everything governing MRF, all of their rules were set by the state. And so, for example, the state, so when MRF had that 50% funding, the problem had been caused by state lack of state oversight, or whatever you want to say, or not thinking through carefully. Another thing that really hurt MRF was the city, this whole concept, which we're continually asked to do. I think we're being asked to do it again in some cases, of the concept of the early retirement, and what the early retirement encouraging members of MRF in the city to take early retirement meant that they could be replaced by lower paid junior members instead of senior members. But the cost of that then goes on to the pension plan, which the city is not responsible for at that time. So it is one of the problems where when we do some of these early retirement programs, the costs and the benefits are not uniformly distributed. And so we need to be very careful is that any benefit that a city gets or local entity gets from early retirement in the ability to hire lower paid people, that you need to look at the very same time as what the problems are for the pension plan. And I think there was a huge chunk of retirees in MRF at one period in this, maybe in the 90s or something like that, that caused that major negative effect on the pension plan.
Sarah Olson, you had a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering if we had a similar chart for contributions by the city. You know, that just kind of and is that something that we also set, Representative Conn? The state has determined the rules that put the fund in this position. Does that mean that we determine how much the city contributes, or is that a discretionary call that the city makes?
Mr. Martin can point to you where the contributions is, and then Representative Conn, if you wish to explain. So.
Members, if you look at starting on page 14 and you go down about two-thirds of the way down the column of numbers, there are both employee and employer contributions, as well as the direct state funding in the contributions chunk of the chart. And if you track back, you can get a sense of the city contributions, which would be the employer and employer additional contribution amounts. The employer additional contribution amount is fairly small, so you can essentially focus on the employer contribution line. The way this is not set as a particular percentage of pay in statute, unlike PERA or TRA or the state retirement system, MRF was required and is required to fund based on its actuarial work. So, in effect, whatever the actuarial work discloses is needed to be contributed to the plan, less whatever the state contributes and what the members contribute becomes the employer contribution to MRF. And so it is highly variable. It is highly affected by the actuarial work and hence the actuarial value of assets. When the Pension Commission and the legislature set the contribution rates for PERA or TRA or MSRS, we look at the actuarial work and we set the statutory rates, but we've never tied the two in a very direct way, one to the other. In MRF and with some of the local police and paid fire plans, we did that differently. We did tie the contribution rates year to year to year directly to the actuarial work. So whatever the actuarial work disclosed was needed as a funding contribution, that's what all the funding sources had to ultimately put in. And the employer bears, the employers in this case, bear the ultimate responsibility of whatever differential that may produce. So,
And since it's a closed fund, we don't have the luxury of just rolling out a date in the future and say, well, just you got 30 years to do it because it's going to come sooner than that. So, Urban Kind, did you have something to add? Or? I'm sorry.
Members, if you look on page 414 and you look at the towards the bottom line, the deficiency line, you'll note that the deficiency is zero for most years, and that's because of this phenomenon where the contributions had to equal the actuarial requirements of the plan.
Sarah Olson?
Mr. Chair, and it does look like, if you just look at least within the last several years, that the employer contributions, I assume mostly from Minneapolis then, have grown steadily over the years from 21% in 2002 up to this year where they're 47%. So it does look like, you know, there's been a drastic increase in the amount of contribution they've had to make.
And when their LGA has been cut, I mean, we're going to probably hear from that soon. Sarah Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is that one of the concerns that, and I've heard many from various entities here, but one of the things that has been brought to my attention, or an argument, I guess, if you will, is that the city of Minneapolis has this this responsibility, this liability for these dollars, but then conversely doesn't have opportunity to design the benefit. And so can somebody here give me a little bit of background on, was that tied to the decision that was made at the time that the state funding was put in place, or is that the way it's been forever, or what's the background on that?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the MRF benefit structure has been in state statute since 1919 when the plan was authorized. Before 1957, before the Constitution was amended for the state of Minnesota to authorize local legislation, it was done by MRF was considered a general statute. It only applied to one pension fund, but it was set without local approval. But for many of the changes that occurred after 1957, the benefit changes in MRF would have been subject to a local approval. Not necessarily always, but in most cases, is my memory. I would have to do further research to document how many times yes and no. But my memory, being here for a fair chunk of that time, is that many of the increases in MRF were subjected to local approval.
Yeah. Any other questions about the overall proposal? Because we do have a lot of people who have an interest in this. And we'll start with the witnesses on the table. Please identify yourself. Welcome to the Pension Commission.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Luther Thompson, the temporary part-time executive director of MRF. And with me is Willie Harris. Don't let his looks and age deceive you. He is the poster child for our retirees. And he'll be testifying. There was a packet of material put into your packet today. And the first is the resolution of the MRF board. And I know Representative Murphy asked a question about membership. The second page there shows the membership statistics and profile as of March 1st of this year. The next page was the asset valuation as of January 31st of this year that was used to come up with the current projected estimates for the deficiency, which is has been talked about, of the $73 million. And the proportion of the various employers and what they share in that liability was on those estimates, and it's kind of got a yellow box. The last part of this is a summary of the Enoscoop projections that were prepared for the board. We heard this back in December, which essentially said that there's a reasonable economic certainty that this plan will go into default in the near term, and that's certainly within 5 to 8 years. So our primary purpose here today is to discuss a bill that is going to avoid default in the pension payments. And we discussed this has been a hard solution for everybody, but commitments have been made, representations have been made that retiree benefits will be paid. This is there. You can look through the record from the city of Minneapolis and the representations that have been made there. Certainly there are going to have to be financial sacrifices, and when we get into the bill, there's an amendment there that shows that the MRF members have agreed to make a substantial sacrifice in what's referred to as a swap, which ranges from either $129 million to $195 million, depending upon which actuarial assumptions you use. I would like to speak, first of all, though, about starting in December, the MRF board had to start wrestling with these numbers. As Representative Thiessen has pointed out, really that it was the issue about the way you value the post fund that really started to cause a problem, because it introduced transparency into the valuation of the post fund. It started valuing those assets at market rather than at cost or book. And so starting in 2007, you'll notice the unfunded liability for MRF started to be recorded at $12.5 million. Last year it was $30 million. And as of June 30th, it's now up to $64 million when you take out the state's contribution. We started with a resolution at the MRF board in December. We passed it in January 20th. I went before the Intergovernmental Relations Council of the city. They praised the efforts of MRF to merge. They were fully supportive of it. I was invited before the PARA board. They listened graciously. And from all of that, we started to work with pension commission staff to draft a bill. And I would be remiss if I didn't certainly recognize Larry Martin's work here. During the last 2 months, he has worked very closely with MRF in trying to come up with a bill that would at least focus everyone on the problem here. And there are really, when you talk about the bill, we've tried to come up with a deliberate, orderly process. There are three principles or components to the bill. Although it's 65 pages long, I think it can be condensed into three principles. First, you have to have a definitive consolidation date. We chose that to be June 30th of 2010. Secondly, you had to mitigate any negative impact on PARA. We have done that in the language. And third, you had to allow sufficient time for the city to adjust and plan financially. We have done that. So what we have tried to do is incorporate the key components into this bill. And the way it's been drafted, I think it does that. A week ago, we sat down again with the city. We came up with some amendments. Larry Martin has drafted those, and we are fully in support of those. One of those does take out the swap that I mentioned, so that it does demonstrate a sacrifice and commitment on behalf of MRF and its members to ensure that this bill gets through. I think what this bill offers, it really offers hope, not despair. It offers hope to those retirees that their checks are going to come. It offers some assurance to PARA that they are going to be able to handle this, and it offers some reasonable assurance to the city they'll have some time to prepare. And it really essentially comes down to money and people. But we know,
amortization dates can be changed, but retiree lives cannot. Waiting is not an option here. We can wait and talk about the process and how we're going to fund it, but these retirees, and you know what the member profile is, there's 4,600 of them. Their average age is 74. There's a dozen over 100. The oldest is 105. They cannot wait. They have no Social Security. Most of them will have no Medicare. And if you do not do this, default will certainly happen, and the cost will certainly increase. So I would simply say that, you know, delay is not an option. If you have any questions about any of the materials, the resolution, the fiduciary responsibility that the board felt in pursuing this, I'd be happy to answer any of those. But I'd like Willie here to offer his comments on behalf of the retirees and himself. Thank you.
Mr. Harris, welcome to the Pensions Commission. You'll need to identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission. My name is Willis Harris. I'm 83 years old. I've been involved in MRF since 1951. When I came to work for the Board of Education, I've been a member of the MRF Board for 28 years. I've been on the association since 1957, so it's a very near and dear thing to me. And Mr. Chairman, as I look around here, there's not many faces I can recall. I can recall Senator Pappas and Representative Murphy and Representative Kahn, and I ask myself, how come they look so great and I look so bedraggled and dragged out?
Well, timers too.
But
these jobs keep us young.
And I mean that sincerely. I think a paramount thing, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that once a month I meet with what we call the old timers. We sit at a table similar to this and have breakfast and just talk about the old times, how great we were and the great things we've done, and the city and the state wouldn't have run without us. But ever since November, the whole complex has changed. Now I sit on one side of the table and all the others sit on the other side, and we have from 15 to 40 people attend these breakfasts. And I gotta say, ladies and gentlemen, they are concerned. They are scared to death. It was pointed out here by Luther that there's some sitting there 88 years old. He's in a wheelchair. There's some at 85. None are below 65. And the first question he asks is, Willie, what's going to happen? What do I do if I lose this pension? And I say, well, I've been around a long time. I've walked these halls for many, many years. And I do feel that in the infinite wisdom of this body and of the legislature, that things will happen and things will be taken care of. But as Luther pointed out, you've got 4,600 people out there that are greatly concerned. They all, the group that I sit with, all have Social Security. How did they get it? After they retired, one went to work for Lunds as a carryout, and he's making $125 a month. He got Social Security through that factor. Another one got Social Security by working in one of the sweat houses. She makes $32.50 a month, but she has Medicare, thank God. The rest have earned it over the years since they retired. One has nothing. And that one scared me. And I asked him, I says, how do you get along? And he's kind of a character. He says, I don't know. I just put it in God's hands, and he provides. But he says, I am slowly going broke. He says, we've used everything we can beg, borrow, and steal to live with, but we're still going. So I hope that something can be done. You know, Mr. Chairman, I go back so far before this commission was even instituted. And I remember the night it was instituted, 1957, by Senator Doeslin from Park Rapids. I believe it was from Mora and Moorhead area. And they had regular meetings called by really the Speaker of the House. And they sat down and listened to what the state's problems were, and he made the comment. He says, we need to have some type of commission set up that we can study and analyze this thing. We don't know what's going on. The funds seem to be running well, but we don't know what's going on, and we're dumping money into it each and every year. And as you recall, in those years, you had sessions every other year. So they formed this commission, and Senator Doslin was on it, and next year came Senator Harmagdahl and two gentlemen from Minneapolis, Representative French and Root, were on it. And they instituted this and brought about the changes. And thank goodness they did. The PRA at the time was in bad shape. MRF seemed to be floating along okay. But in 1969, MRF was taken away from us. 2:30 in the morning, they just put an amendment into a bill that dissolved us all except the active folks. Well, we were upset, to say the least. For the next 11 years, we worked very hard and diligently to get our fund back. And during the 70s, as you recall, the market was chaos. But MRF seemed to be able to go 5, 6, 7, 8%. The state wasn't even making 3 and 4. At that time, you had to have 5% to run the fund. And it was difficult to make. So we premised our whole attack upon that. Every commission meeting, every GovOp meeting, we were there with the signs and the pickets, and that we can do better. And we got the mayor of Minneapolis, the city council, this commission, to agree to it. In 1981, we were given back the fund. But we knew then, we back up to 79 when we were phased out, that we knew then that within a matter of years, the state would call us back because we would become so small that one end wasn't given enough money to push the other end, so we were slowly go broke. We knew that then. The state knew that then. That was emphasized by this legislature and by this body. And so it be it. It has come to pass. And we've done a good job. And I must back up and give Howie Bicker a pat on the back. In the 80s, once he come down the road and took over, the state became funded, and he done a marvelous job and bailed a lot of people out. He made everybody work harder. I think the question being then, could MRF do better than the state? So there was a constant battle each and every year to do better than the state. We've done as good, in some cases better, but that's immaterial. We come to the day where we face, again, reality for our people. We're here. We're concerned. If we weren't, we wouldn't be here. I think that the bill that's drafted can suffice and do a good job. And Mr. Chairman, I call upon your body, as and again in their infinite wisdom, to come about and approve some sort of type form of bill that can take care of the situation and make it solvent. With that, I thank you again for this opportunity and stand for questions.
Well, thank you, Mr. Harris. It was very informative. Any questions of Mr. Thompson or Mr. Harris? There are other people who do want to testify, too, but I want to make sure that if there are any questions of these two witnesses. If not, I do have Leonard Crum and Brian Locason listed as people who do wish to testify. Could they come forward? Welcome to the Pensions Commission. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Brian Locasmo, and I am the current president of the MRF Board. I would like to note that there are three other MRF Board members here with us today: Mr. Dennis Solsted, who is our vice president; Mr. Jim Lind, who is a past president and longtime member of the board; and Ms. Heather Johnston is here, who is the mayor's appointed representative to the MRF Board. We're pleased to see the progress that has been made recently in moving forward with the consolidation of the Minneapolis Employees Retirement Fund with PERA. We see this action as the final step in a process that began 30 years ago when the legislature took action to close the MRF fund to new members and directed that all new employees of the City of Minneapolis, as well as new employees from the School Board, Metropolitan Airports Commission, Minnesota State College and University System, some Hennepin County folks, Met Council employees, and even some Minnesota Court System employees, that all of people currently who would have been enrolled in MRF in the future would all be enrolled as members of PERA. In 1979, when this event took place, there were over 6,000 active MRF members working for these employees, in addition to over 3,000 retired members. Altogether, the fund had a membership that exceeded 10,000 at that point in time. Today, our membership is less than 5,000, with only 200 of those actively working employees and the remainder already retired employees represented by the MRF Fund. As this past 30 years has gone by, we have always recognized that at some point in time, MRF would cease to exist, with the remaining members being consolidated into another government pension fund. We used to like to joke about that, you know, gee, does the last guy get all the money that's left, or does he owe the bill? Mm-hmm. And but we realized that that isn't what was going to occur, that it was going to get consolidated somewhere at a time in the future. The most likely case always being a consolidation with PERA, where our current City of Minneapolis active employees and other former MRF employers, where their employees had become enrolled. That time has come. In 2008, the MRF board took an action to transfer the management of our assets to the State Board of Investment, which manages the assets of many other state-regulated pension funds, including PERA. We felt this was a transition that should take place in preparation for a more seamless consolidation of MRF with PERA. The MRF board, we take our fiduciary responsibilities to our members very seriously and saw this change as a reasonable and prudent move in that the investment practices of MRF and the SBI were very similar and historically have provided almost identical investment results. This change took place during August and September of 2008. We then began seriously discussing how to best proceed with the next steps of effecting a consolidation of MRF with PERA. As our fixed membership continues to decrease, this is an issue of increasing importance at this time. Since beginning this initiative, our economy has been severely impacted by a number of external factors. This has, of course, changed our financial situation along with everyone else's. We realize that this has added a degree of complexity to working out the financial details of a consolidation, but has not changed the underlying reasons why this is an important action to take. We appreciate your concern regarding this issue and encourage you to move forward with an approval of the legislation required for the principal parties to move forward and work out the remaining details to accomplish this consolidation in a timely manner. This initiative has the unanimous support of the MRF board. I thank you for your time and attention, and if you have any questions for us, we'll remain available to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Locksmull. Any questions of him? Okay, and you also have, let's see, is Mr. Crum?
Yes. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and commission members. My name is Leonard Crum. I'm the president of the Minneapolis Municipal Retirement Association. MMRA was created by the legislature around 1920 for the purpose of electing the board representatives to MRF and to support its membership. I'm 62 years old, one of the younger people receiving a MRF pension. You've just heard that some pensioners are over 100 years old. Everyone else is somewhere in between those centurions and me. Many of the MRF retirees live in nursing homes, you know, some in assisted living facilities. Many are totally dependent on the monthly pension check that they receive from MRF. You've also heard that most of us do not receive Social Security benefits. Those of us that do receive the benefits get a reduced benefit due to the federal government's pension reduction offset plan that's implemented by the Social Security Administration. The MMRA board has been meeting weekly for months. We've thoroughly discussed the issue. Several current and past board members are in this room with us today. The MMRA board is unanimous in supporting the MRF board in its efforts to consolidate our pension with PARA. I'd like to thank you for having us here today and considering what we put before you.
Thank you. Any questions? Before we get too far in, before I forget, Ms. Vanek, as I said, we're not going to take action today, but does PERA have a position? Obviously, you don't want to take over a fund that's underfunded, but are there any issues that the PERA is looking at in this process, or are you prepared to testify today at all?
Okay. Mr. Chair, if you have no more questions, may I thank you, and I particularly thank you and Representative Thiessen for carrying this bill forward. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you. Ms. Vanek.
Mr. Chair, members, Mary Vanek, PERA Director. The PERA Board of Trustees has not taken a formal position on the merger of MRF and PERA at this time. They have directed that I should continue to work with all the parties involved. Our unstated official position is that as fiduciaries of the plan, the consolidation or the merger of MRF needs to be fully funded. The cost implications of bringing MRF in without the funding increases contributions to our members at over 1% of pay, and our members and employers have just recently stepped up to help keep this plan in good shape, and that would not be accepted. And I appreciate Representative Thiessen's comment to the effect that that is not the proposal. It isn't in the bill, and we don't expect to see anything to that effect. So we will continue to work with all the parties and see if we can come up with some reasonable solution. We understand it's serious and that we are the most practical solution for this.
Thank you. It's my understanding that, again, the City of Minneapolis is still working on it. Do they wish to weigh in and provide any information at this time that you can discuss? Welcome to the Pensions Commission. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Pat Bourne. I'm the Chief Financial Officer of the City. I'll not dwell on our situation other than to say that the City is on record as supporting this merger, but the reality of the cost of doing so needs to be considered. Under the bill as it's currently drafted and envisioned, Minneapolis's share of the cost to amortize the unfunded liability is $46 million a year for 23 years beginning next year. Just to put that into a little bit of perspective, $46 million is just shy of the fire department's budget of $50 million a year. $46 million would be a 19% increase in the property tax levy in Minneapolis, and it would roughly double the contributions that we're currently making to all of our closed pension funds. We certainly welcome and thank Representative Thiessen for his leadership, and look forward to working with the other employers, PARA, MRF, and its membership organization, who has, I think, taken a bold step in agreeing to the provisions of the bill that they have. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions, Board? Okay. I'm going to ask in a moment our staff to kind of go through the amendments that we've got, just so we know if there's some options here. As I say, we're not able to take any action today because we want to wait until we get all the information before us, which we don't quite have. But is there anybody else who came today who wants to be heard on this topic? Please come forward. Representative Murphy.
Can I ask Representative Thiessen a question? You said $46 million a year for next 23 years, and he said 40-something million. Is his 40-something million the same as the $46 million you were talking about for us?
Mr. Barnum.
Is it just one 40-something million?
It's a total of $60 million, setting aside the state's $9 million, and the Minneapolis share would be $46 million.
Mr. Bourne, is
so I don't know if that answers you.
Mr. Bourne, could you clarify what you're looking at?
It would be foolish for me to contradict Representative Thiessen, so I won't, and I agree with
well,
him completely.
Unless you got better numbers. I mean, you're okay.
So, So are we talking a 40-something million for Minneapolis and a 40-something million a year for the state?
No.
It's 140-something million.
Just one.
Okay. For 23 years, reoccurring. Yes. Thank you.
Okay. Good. Senator Lynch.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and Representative Thiessen and to the city of Minneapolis, isn't this $46 million that we're talking about, would it be an accurate statement to say that at this particular moment in time, that's the amount that we're looking at? But isn't that amount subject to change? And as we've seen, based on the funding ratio, based on the investment returns, is that $46 million firm? Or would you suggest that $46 million is a good number today, but is subject to change for better or worse?
Yeah, Mr. Bourne?
Mr. Chair and members, just to put this into perspective, the amount to amortize the unfunded liability under the current valuation of the fund and the current view of the time to amortize the unfunded liability would be 23 years. The total amount is, I think, close to $75 million per year for 23 years. Minneapolis's share is 71-72% of that. My partner in crime here, my counterpart at the Minneapolis Public Schools, will speak to their share and the burden that would present for them. As well, and I obviously don't want to steal her thunder either, but I think depending on how the bill could be drafted, the amount of the annual payment to amortize the unfunded liability could change if you choose to draft the bill that way. I think there are any number of solutions that perhaps the working group can get together, talk about, and bring our recommendations back to you.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. And that's one of the reasons we want a little more time, is to kind of maybe build in a true-up mechanism. But I want to emphasize that the returns to actually make a huge difference in that amount are going to have to be like 25%. I mean, they're going to have to be extraordinary returns, I think, would be a fair estimate, just because of what the payout is and the amount in the fund. So that is true. If returns come back, we can do a true-up mechanism to try to minimize that effect. But it's not going to have I don't anticipate it's going to have a substantial change.
Sarah Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Thiessen. Just so I'm clear, because I thought I was following this real well, and then I got confused again. Of the annual payment that's needed to fund the unfunded liability, your proposal proposes that the state pay what percentage of what would otherwise be the responsibility of Minneapolis and the
As the bill is drafted, the state share is $9 million and doesn't change that. So under the bill of the $73, $74 million, $9 million, which is the current state share, is the state share, and then the remainder is divided up among mainly the school district and the city of Minneapolis as the bill is currently drafted. At the beginning, my comments at the beginning, though, were to suggest that as we move forward on this, we may want to rethink that somewhat for a variety of reasons. And so, but the way the bill is drafted today, it's $9 million to the state, about $46 million under current numbers to the city, about $14 million to the school district, and then the remainder for the other employers.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, so how is that different than current law, since I thought $9 million was the cap and that's what we've been doing? Or was this just a vehicle to start that discussion to be?
Mr. Chair, this is different from current law because what's different under this bill is we'd be merging in. What the bill proposes, though, in terms of the funding share is not really different than current law as it's drafted.
Okay.
Yeah.
Ms. Ward.
Mr. Chair and members, it may be just instructive for commission members who aren't familiar with this plan. The employer's responsibility for annual funding addresses the current employees, the 200 or so active employees. Our contributions are aimed at and have always been aimed at funding each person's retirement at the point of their retirement. Once somebody then moves to the post fund, and MRF has a post fund, the post fund itself is then responsible to make and fund the annual retirement payments. the employers are no longer responsible, and the state is no longer responsible to make up any deficiencies in the post fund. So what this proposal does is to bring the employers into a state of financial responsibility that we don't now have. That is, the employers like Minneapolis Public Schools, don't have a responsibility to fund the post funds deficiencies under current law. And that is what is bringing us all together today, because the retirees themselves are looking to, obviously, all of us to help resolve the deficiency that exists in the post fund.
And Mr. Chair, that's correct. I was incorrect, yes. I think, in my description.
Senator Olson. I see. Ms. Vanek, you came back to the table. Do you have something you wanted to raise before we get to the next witness?
Mr. Chair, members, I just wanted to reaffirm what Representative Thiessen was saying. We have spoken to our actuary about what our goal would be is if this merger is going to happen July 1, 2010, we take a snapshot at that point in time with some hope of some market recovery, and recognizing the true experience, if there have been some parties that have died in the meantime, is going to make a difference. We don't expect it to be significant, but we also would like the opportunity to have the discussion about, because we're asking that MRFs unfunded be specifically addressed and taken care of through this annual contribution, that there be some, what Representative Thiessen refers to as a true-up. So we look at experience a few years down the road and see if that payment can be adjusted because of positive returns or other things happening in the fund. And we want to be careful about that, but we'd like to have that discussion.
We have another witness who came forward. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Peggy Ingeson, and I'm the Chief Financial Officer for Minneapolis Public Schools. And I just wanted to make a point consistent with Mr. Bourne from the City of Minneapolis Finance, that recognizing the need for the legislation and the problem. And I think it's been really useful to hear a little bit about the history, Mr. Chair, and if anything, we see that the efforts made by the state over the years to consolidate these individual funds into statewide plans, that basically there's kind of safety in numbers. And I think that when we see the effects of what's happened just in the last couple of years with the MRF fund, Mr. Chair and members, I had some responsibility for looking at these kinds of things when I was served in the finance department and also served as Senate staff in looking at this. And I think that the legislature has tried to be attentive to some of the places where we know that there have been problems. And by including the state appropriation to MRF quite a few years ago now, and recognizing that contribution was at times adequate, at times more than adequate to meet what the needs were. I think that one of the things that makes the problems in the MRF fund so unique is that it is a closed fund and has only had the contributions of employees and no new employees coming into the fund. What you see at the funding ratio as of 2008, not based on the newest actuarial analysis that's been done, but, you know, a funding ratio in the 70% range isn't unlike what's occurred with a lot of the statewide funds in recent years, with the recognition of the post-fund obligation included there. So where many funds appeared to be adequately funded years back, now are not. And I think the problem in particular with the MRF fund is this pending problem with the inability to sometime in the next decade be unable to pay retirees their entitled benefits. And so, Mr. Chair and members, I just am concerned about any obligations that would occur to the school district. When we really look at the what's occurred over just simply the last year, a funding requirement of $30 million jumping to $70-plus million. And I think our concerns about what might be expected in the coming year, and the concern that we have about how we all share in the responsibilities of the fund here. And really, when we think about the taxpayers of the city of Minneapolis taking responsibility for both the city employees and the school district employees, it's a very significant burden, and it would be in the $60-plus million range. And that is the amount of the levy referendum for education operating expenses that we just asked the taxpayers of Minneapolis to support this last November. Again, I think that looking at this as a broader sharing kind of arrangement, we certainly recognize the need to do something about it, but we are also facing a $28 million shortfall in the school district for the coming year that we're busy working on right now, and understand that that there are plans, understand the state financial situation and plans that we may have to plan for larger cuts in the coming year than that. So I just want to make the point that we understand the need for the legislation, the importance of doing something, but concern about the obligation that we have, that we might have as an employer.
Welcome back to the Capitol.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Thiessen.
At some point along, I'd like to get a little bit more insight, because kind of the way that the testimony is playing out, and this is just becoming, it's actually something I've been thinking through a lot. But it strikes me that the way this is set up, and there's a little bit in number 7 here in the memo on this, there's really no backstop on this fund in terms of, at least written into statute. You know, the city is saying they are not required to kind of fill in the gap, and the school district would be in the same position as a local employer. The state is, you know, capped at $9 million, I guess. Are there legal liabilities here? Does anybody have responsibility other than the fund members?
Before we do that, is there anybody else? Yeah. Any questions of the Muzingison or the other witnesses that are here? So, okay. And Mr. Martin, could you address that? And if there's anybody else who wants to be heard on this, please come up, because then I'm going to ask Mr. Martin to go through the memo and some of the options here. Mr. Martin.
Well, members, what I can give you is an imperfect picture. We've only had one pension fund in Minnesota ever go bankrupt. That was the predecessor to TRA. The law in 1931 was much different than the law is right now. The legislature actually reduced the benefits of the predecessor to TRA for the retirees by one half of their dollar amount, paid the other half. And those were not restored until 1957 or 1959 to their full amount. And there was no litigation over that. It was a time where pensions were looked on as a gratuity that the government provided to its employees at its will. And if it changed its mind, it could. That's not the state of the law in Minnesota currently, at least since 1973 in the Silvestri case and the subsequent case of Christensen, where pensions are either a contract or a quasi-contract promissory estoppel arrangement, where the state is basically bound or the employer is basically bound. We have self-insured pension plans. There's no explicit statement in Minnesota statutes to that effect, but that is the functional situation. We don't buy insurance to cover funding defaults. We're not covered by the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. We don't pay a premium, and we don't get any plan termination or plan default protection from the federal government or any other insurance arrangement. These are self-insured pension plans, and the enterprise that's going to be providing the insurance is the state of Minnesota or whatever employers are related to that pension plan in all probability. So the backstop here is general creditor remedies that the retirees would have against the employer the day that there's 90 cents in the till and a dollar is owing.
Sarah Olson.
Mr. Chair,
I'm not sure I understand this, and I think it's really important that we have a good understanding of the law in this area, because on the one hand, I heard Minneapolis say that they're not bound beyond having funded at the time of retirement, you know, and then the pension fund is then responsible after that for the wisdom of how the investments are made. But then I heard, I hear that it's the employer is bound. So I think it's important to understand the law because honestly, although we all hope the economy is going to turn around, you know, we have other pension funds as well that if things got bad enough could be facing similar kinds of issues. And it would be good to have a uniform policy about what the state's responsibilities are as compared to, say, the cities, as compared to the pension funds. I mean, just because we know what our legal liabilities are doesn't mean that we wouldn't want to do something more than that. But we certainly have to honor our legal liabilities. But I think that's something we need to understand.
If you desire, I mean, as I say, we can't resolve this one today, but either Mark Shepard from the House or Tom Bodner from the Senate, you know, as legal counsel for the House and Senate committees that oversee this can address those issues if that's the will or desire of the commission. So.
Members, I also can, I think, help a little bit in squaring up Mr. Boren's testimony with what I just told you. There's no specific statutory provision that requires Minneapolis at any point in time or any other employer connected with the Minnesota Public Pension Plan to do something specifically, to include in their budget a specific dollar amount when a pension plan comes to, if a self-insured pension plan suddenly is on the verge of defaulting. So I think what he's telling you is there's nothing in statute that tells Minneapolis that they have to pay dollar X at some point in time. It's really common law. I was a practicing lawyer once upon a time. I no longer have a active practice license, so I'm not going to give you a legal opinion. But as an educated layman, there is a common law that underlies all of these. When you set up a self-insurance arrangement, that does not relieve the debtor, from our responsibilities if that self-insurance pool goes bust. And that's the situation we would be in. And it's a general law, it's a general common law proposition. So Mr. Bourne is telling you what specifically statute does or does not provide, and he's accurate. There's nothing that says that Minneapolis or any other of the MRF employers owe any particular amount the day that the till goes dry. But like any other debt that's owed through a self-insurance pool, the existence of a self-insurance pool does not relieve the debtor of the debt.
Yeah. Sarah Olson.
So, Mr. Chair, in other words, you're saying that they have a contract responsibility they would have to honor, even though we don't specifically say how much they have to put into the pool every year in order to honor that contract responsibility, but that ultimate underlying contract responsibility is there?
Yeah, Ms. Martin?
Slightly different. Yes, I'm talking about a default. We do have a statute does tell the city of Minneapolis and the various employing units that are covered by MRF what has to go into the plan year to year to year, and it's based on the actuarial work of the plan. And it's greatly affected by the change in the asset valuation following the changing view of what generally accepted accounting principles are required back in 2007. But it's never measured by a default measurement that we owe $100 million to the retirees this year and we only have $97 million in the till. It's based on amortizing an unfunded accrued liability over a certain period of time, which probably extends beyond the working career of the last retiree in MRF, or last active member who's about to retire in MRF.
Sarah Olson.
So Mr. Chair, then, just again, this may be an oversimplification of, but within that oversimplification, the state would have those, I'm then assuming, those similar types of contractual responsibilities to the state employees that we need to be cognizant of in terms of being able to make sure that we have the money to meet those responsibilities for the funds that where we have those responsibilities. It sounds like the city, the school district, has those responsibilities to its employees. And then the question becomes to what degree the state should help them meet those contractual responsibilities because of how severe the problem is. I mean, is that kind of in a nutshell the situation we're faced?
Ms. Martin?
Yes, I think that is the case. The only difference between MRF and our other public employee pension plans is that we have phased out the active membership in this pension plan. So we've constricted somewhat arbitrarily isn't quite the right word, but unlike the general employees plan for the state of Minnesota or PERA, where there are ongoing active members in the plan and a full complement of member and employer contributions based on those active members and a large active membership compared to the retired membership, MRF since 1978-79 has not been in that circumstance. It is a reducing group of active members. And so the influx of new money into MRF in the normal stream of things is different than one of our regular plans, making this a more precarious funding situation. And some of the testimony from the three MRF representatives mentioned that this is a more precarious circumstance. When you start phasing out a plan, you have a problem in getting that plan to full funding before the active members all retire. And then if you have the additional problem of having a pair of recessions in fairly short order and an accounting change, that all makes it more critical.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. One more kind of historical piece here. Have for PERA, has the state or any other source of revenue outside of PERA ever been infused into PERA to bail it out in a sense?
Mr. Chairman, members, a direct state aid to PERA you're thinking of, or?
Or any kind of lump sum infusion? I remember something about TRA and PERA at some point in time. And I don't know if there's any state general fund dollars that ever went into.
Well, Ms. Vanek can probably give you some history here. About 10 years ago, PERA was in dire straits. But Ms. Vanek?
Mr. Chair and members, Mary Vanek, PERA. I hope it wasn't really dire straits, but we needed some help.
I can seems tell so you, at the time.
Some, I know. It's been a long time. 1984, there was a shift of PERA member or employer contributions. Our employer contributions were reduced with the expectation that we were on a road to be fully funded, and we were only 78% funded at the time. But our employer contribution to our coordinated plan were reduced because they thought we were going to get fully funded before we needed to be. So there was some shifting so that TRA could get additional funding at that time. Then in 1997, because of some assumption changes that we needed to make, and our funding needed to be shored up, and TRA was over 100% funded at the time, and so was MSRS. So employer contributions were reduced for those plans, and money was shifted to go out to local governments. We received no direct appropriation, but there I think it's about $14 million still that is distributed to local units of government based on the 1997 payroll to help them pay for an increase in contributions to PERA at that time. So it's not a direct state appropriation, but it is available to local government to help them cover their PERA cost.
Members, the only thing I would add, and she's right about the two instances where the PERA contribution was reduced following the early 80s budget crisis and the need to try and bolster TRA funding, and then the reverse circumstance that occurred in 97. The reason why there is a pension commission has to do with PERA and some funding problems in the early 50s. So the state did, when PERA was a voluntary, not a mandatory, membership organization, and when there was no specific employer contribution, the legislature did intervene, although not with state money. But they did start making PERA mandatory membership for local government and mandated in employer contribution to avoid what otherwise would have been a default. So that's an unusual legislative intrusion into what otherwise would have been a problem, although not with state money at that point.
Your President Thiessen.
And one other question. In 1979 or whenever the – at that time when MRF was left as a standalone fund, a bunch of other cities came into PARA. Is that correct or am I mistaken about – were there other individual city plans that were merged into PARA at that time?
Mr. Chair, members, there weren't any general employee city plans. There only have ever been two general employee plans, local plans. One was the St. Paul Bureau of Health, which was closed to new members in 69 and finally merged into PERA in 1973, and MRF. There were a number of police and paid fire plans where the plans were closed off to new members in 1980 by general legislation.
Did those
earlier by special legislation, ultimately consolidated with PERA in 1987 and finally merged with PERA, Police and Fire, in 1999.
And, Mr. Chair, did those come in fully funded?
Mr. Chair, members, they came in either with comparable funding to PERA or the requirement that the city over a period of years pay additional assets to bring them up to a comparable funding level. And indeed, this is the last year under the 1999 piece of legislation for the six or eight that were gross, maybe it's more than eight, grossly unfunded or problematic funds to make their last contribution, the last annual contribution on this 10-year stream.
So, Mr. Chair, so PARA was held harmless in each of those instances, the current membership. Okay.
Any other questions of Ms. Vanek, or does Ms. Vanek have anything further to add? Okay. Mr. Martin, could you just, as I say, although we're not going to be taking action, could you flag the issues that are before us and maybe some amendments that we should keep in our mind as for the next time we take the bill up?
Yes, members, I think if you take a look at the executive summary or the memo, I think the first five policy issues that are discussed have been adequately covered by the discussion and testimony. Item six, I would draw your attention to this. You would find on the bottom of page six, the question of the benefit impact on MRF members, and then item seven, the contribution to the consolidation funding issue that MRF members are making or not making. The bill as drafted holds the MRF membership harmless. It gives them their current level of benefits. It also provides for what is referred to as the swap. This is the MRF post-retirement adjustment mechanism is potentially more valuable than the post-retirement adjustment mechanism in the statewide plans. It has a different in functional cap, a functional cap of 3.5% annual increase per year on its CPI portion of the adjustment as compared to a flat 2.5% post-retirement increase in the statewide plans. And so that 1% potential difference in post-retirement increases can either be paid out 1% more each year over time as it occurs, or it can be reduced to an additional benefit amount, which has the present value, the actual value of that stream of 1% additional increases. And so this bill provides for an additional one-time benefit increase to buy that would have the same actuarial value as the 1% additional post-retirement adjustment that MRF employees potentially have, depending upon what the cost of living is in the future and other factors. That does come at a price tag, and that's really covered by item 7 and 2 of the amendments that are in your packets, Amendment 3A and Amendment 4A. If you have the retirees not take that benefit swap, it's worth an estimated $130 million almost.
And Mr. Chair, the MRF, I think we had testimony earlier that the MRF membership has voted to essentially agree to Amendment 3A, so to not take that benefit swap. So as we proceed here, I think we'll want to include that one.
Sure. When I drafted the memo, I didn't know what position the MRF Association would take, and 4A gave you the opportunity if not doing the total swap wasn't acceptable, maybe not taking a portion of the total swap might have been, and so that would give you that vehicle.
Mr. Martin, that dollar amount, is that total, or is that yearly? Or?
Members, that would be a total amount. That would be the actuarial accrued liability in today's terms that would be associated with that 1%.
And, Mr. Chair, just to be clear, I think I'm right on this, that taking that swap out is actually built into the numbers we were talking about earlier. So that's not going to – is that correct?
Yeah, Mr. Thompson?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. We did estimate the present value of that swap, and that number is not contained in the numbers that we used using the para assumptions and the new amortization date of 2031.
Members, I don't want to unduly complicate things from a legal standpoint, but I do want to observe that while the MRF Association could say that they, as a group, don't want it, there is an open question about how binding that is on the individual MRF members. The courts in Minnesota have recognized an informal bargaining by group in the past, actually with a group of judges. In the case of Anderson versus State of Minnesota in 1973, they recognized informal bargaining that was binding on individual judges who were not participants in the actual bargaining and who were adversely affected by a trade of one benefit for another. And that was with judges. To my knowledge, the Minnesota Supreme Court has not revisited or cited Anderson, so no one knows what the current court's view of a case that's 35 or 36 years old really is anymore. So I do want to alert you that having the agreement of the MRF Association gets you part of the way there. It doesn't necessarily bring you along with no possibility of adverse litigation. So 3A and 4A. 5A has to do with the effect of a consolidation on the state of Minnesota. The bill, as drafted, continues the $9 million that MRF currently is eligible to receive from the state of Minnesota until 2020. If you want to extend the MRF state aid longer than 2020, an amendment would be needed to extend it, and the 5A amendment would add a new date rather than 2020, and it's a date that you need to specify. Some of the actuarial work or all of the actuarial work is presumed a 2031 extension, and so that would be one of the possible candidates.
And regardless, if whatever we do on that, the bills as they proceed would have to go to the House Finance and Ways and Means Committee, the Senate Finance Committee, so they would be looking at those issues as to, you know, the funding down the road, you know, for the state contribution.
Since
we don't have an appropriation in here, so the bill always goes to the fiscal route, so they can look at that. So, Sarah Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, whose budget is this in?
State government budget.
It is.
Yes. It doesn't show up as a line item because it's kind of a standing appropriation. In the Senate, the first meeting we had this year, we kind of went through some of the items that never show up, but that we do fund, and we'll be looking at that again so that we can be aware of what's in there. So it's part of the state government budget bill. Mr. Martin, yeah.
Better for worse, the various pension aids used to all be in the state government division, and some of them have now been put into the tax committee's division or their budget targets. So. The police and fire state aids, the amortization aids, for instance, are in the tax committee. They are concerned because they don't understand what those fund and don't understand how they got those dollar amounts in their budget.
They must have money.
Bigot target.
Yes.
6A, item number 10 in the memo has to do with local approval. As initially Well, the bill as drafted does not provide for local approval with the change, the consolidation of MRF into PERA. 6A would add a local approval clause to other legislation. Sometimes we have done MRF without local approval. Sometimes we have not done MRF with local approval when it comes to benefit increases or other provisions. It's arguable that although there's economic implications for Minneapolis and the other employers related to MRF, there's also implications for the state of Minnesota and whether this is purely local and should be made purely effective on local approval or not is an open question. But if you resolve that it would be better to do this with local approval, it gives you that vehicle. And the last amendment that's talked about, substantive amendment that's talked about in the memo is for item 11. This is the current MRF employees and what their future will be. A practical item always when we're consolidating pension funds that happen to have employees, and something a little bit out of our purview. There is a rewrite of how to handle the MRF employees as that's in the 7A amendment. My understanding is that PERA would absorb two of the three MRF employees, and the city of Minneapolis would absorb the third employee, and that's the way this language reflects that shift. Continues them at a comparable salary based on their employment and expertise and education for a year, or allows them to take a severance payment of 1 year's salary.
And Mr. Chair, the PRA and the city seem to indicate that is a correct understanding.
Okay.
There's one technical amendment in your packets, the 2A amendment. There's a, for whatever reason, employer and employee, when one is typing, is sometimes too many E's get in and not enough R's get in. Mm-hmm. And so we have 2A corrects an incorrect reference to employee when it should be employer. In my pack or with me today, I found an additional technical amendment yesterday, a 9A amendment, which when putting together the formula that specifies the additional contributions that the city of Minneapolis and the other MRF-covered employers have to make. I was good on the formula through calculating what the liability is and calculating all these subtractions of the present values of various new or applicable contribution streams, but forgot to set it in relationship to the PERA funded ratio, which was a key part of what I was told to do. So I have the language that corrects that. There's one other amendment that we deferred until we handled this bill as part of the post-fund cleanup bill. There is an error that I made last year in having to do with MRF and what CAP applies to its post-retirement adjustment. Remember the post-fund bill last year, MRF was required to comply with the State Board of Investments post-fund statute, and it seemed somewhat bizarre to have MRF looking to a State Board of Investment statute when the post-fund was dissolved. And so we rolled the applicable provisions that used to relate to the State Board of Investment, a parallel item in the MRF law to specify how the benefits were calculated. One item that shouldn't have been moved into the MRF law got moved into the MRF law, has the practical effect of capping their post-retirement adjustments, depending on how you read it, at 1% rather than 3.5%. And so a correction of that, what I believe was my error in inappropriate inclusion last year, I do have the language that would clean that up.
And is that drawn to the bill here or to the omnibus bill?
Well, it was drawn to the MRF, to the post-fund cleanup bill,
okay.
But it's just a freestanding section.
Why don't we have that?
Pass it out.
Since it's kind of separate from the rest of the MRF issue, maybe we can actually address that now so we don't have to
The rest of the MRF bill, I think, is going to have to hold off until we have all the information from the city of Minneapolis. So let's get that done.
So, members, what you're seeing is the 777-4A document. The Senate file 777 was the post-fund dissolution bill. And
so, but rather than amend this, the 777, that, we've already done that. So this will actually be amended into the omnibus bill,
yes,
if we adopt
it. And the key item that you're looking at is on page 2, lines 1 through 3, where there was the inclusion of two different possible caps. The difference between the pre-retirement and post-retirement adjustment or interest rates, or 3.5. What it should have read was just 3.5. The language that stricken was applicable to the statewide plans based on what happened in 1997, but shouldn't have been applied to MRF.
Okay.
And this would be made retroactive since MRF paid its January 1, 2009 increase without reference to that error. This backs up the provision to June 30, 2008, so it covers the post-retirement adjustment that's already been paid.
Okay. I don't know if Mr. Thompson's seen this, or is anybody you're aware of this one? It looks like it's dated February 25th. Mr. Martin mentioned me this one quite a while back. Are you aware of this?
Right. Mr. Chairman, right, and we appreciate you hearing this. I mean, this was in the process of going through with the actuaries on the consolidation bill. It was actually Para's actuary discovered this and said it was not understandable, and we realized the error. We went back and looked, and there was a clear error coming out of the revisor's office, yeah. Dropped a period and a four, changed the whole meaning, ended up with two different caps, and I appreciate Mr. Martin drafting this.
So this works now for
him. Yes. Okay. Yes, it does.
Is there a motion to adopt the 4A amendment to Senate File 7? Senator Lynch, you will.
Senator Lynch, I'll move adoption of
4A. Senator Lynch moves the adoption of 4A. Discussion of that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, the amendment is adopted to the omnibus pension bill. Is there anybody else, again, who wants to be heard on the MRF issue today? We are going to be laying it over. Rather than acting on some of the amendments today, it seems fair to me that we just wait until we have all the information before us, because although, for instance, maybe the employees have agreed to the uniform swap, that could change depending upon what other things come for us. So rather than amend the bill right now, let's just hold off until we have everything. So if there's anything further, let me just give you a quick idea of what's coming up, members. Tuesday night, and I'm aware it's St. Patrick's Day, Representative Murphy. Okay, I'm worried. But Tuesday night, we're going to be meeting at 7 p.m., not in this room, though, it'll be room 123, because I anticipate there may be more members of the public who want to be at that meeting. I try to get room 15, but that's booked for Judiciary Committee that night, so 123 is the next largest room we've got. We have two bills that are on the agenda that we need to process. We do have the language now from the governor's proposal on the correction employees retirement plan, and that language is actually in the public safety bill that Representative Paymar introduced as the governor's public safety budget bill. Now, Representative Paymar is not going to be here. He introduced the governor's bill. So we'll have the language for that's being proposed. And this will be the opportunity to learn more about it, to get some testimony on it, and so forth. Like the Iran one early issue during today, I don't know how far we can go with it, because it's a corrections budget issue, and it's also a health care issue. But because it clearly is a pension issue, we do need to have some testimony and hear a bit more on it. Next Friday, a week from today, we've got two bills scheduled. The big one is going to be the TRA bill. That'll be next Friday. I'm hoping to get done by 12:30, but if we have to go beyond 12:30, because that's our last really scheduled meeting, but we got to finish that bill. I do not even plan to try to schedule a meeting during the first deadline week. It's going to be impossible with all the craziness that goes around here. But sometime after March 27th, we will have a meeting of the Pensions Commission.
to get the technical issues dealt with on the omnibus bill, so we clean up that. If there's any emergency issues that come up that we haven't heard about yet that actually have to get done this session, you know, we'll be open to doing that. But that's the cleanup session. We have two major outstanding issues we have to deal with. The St. Paul teachers issue has to be dealt with. If we can deal with it next Friday, we'll try to do that. But we have to do something because that pilot project is going to expire this year. We might just consider just extending it on and then working on the over issue of the other. But one way or another, we have to make a decision this session on that. And then we the MRF issue. And as I say, if we can work it out that the MRF issues are resolved to get it into the omnibus bill before it meets second deadline, we'll do that. But if not, I can't hold the bill up. It's got to keep moving. And if necessary, as I say, maybe we can just – we'll talk about other options later on, including just moving the MRF bill out separately. So I want to get the MRF thing done right, but as I indicated earlier, we can't – you know, there's a point in time when we really do have to move this stuff. So any questions about what's coming up here? So if not, have a good weekend. Meeting's adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good trip. Okay.